Well, thanks for coming, and if there's anything that I say that doesn't make sense in your point of view, let me know. I don't have all the answers, please understand that, but I have done a fair amount of investigation into this to make sense. And we are in the minority, of course, in this culture, as we mentioned. Many people scoff at the first few chapters of Genesis. But last week, if you were here, you remember John and Julie got up and told us about their experience going into this monstrosity and marveling how 8 people could maintain what was required with all these animals. Now, tonight we won't be looking at animals and so on. That'll be next week. We're going to look at more of the world features which come as a result of the flood. But we did start out last week pointing out that if we're here to see if science can prove the Bible, that's not what it's for. We, as Jeremy pointed out in March, we start with the fact that God exists. We start with the fact the Bible is true. And from there, we then appeal to people. And so the reason we do this is so that we can comprehend a little more of God's majesty and his glory in what he has done. So last week, if you remember, we did a brief survey of some of the references in the New Testament for those first 11 chapters. And those first 11 chapters include creation and the flood, which are the greatest two events which are under attack. And we see that Jesus referred to the first 7 chapters of Genesis, which include the flood. The New Testament refers to the first 11 chapters of Genesis 71 times, and we gave you the list last week. Excuse me. And every New Testament writer refers to those 11 chapters somewhere, except for chapter 8. And they accept it as being historically accurate. There are some books that don't mention it, but then some books that don't mention that Jesus was nailed to a cross either. It doesn't mean we throw them out, right? We accept the fact that Jesus was nailed to a cross just because it is referred to. So then we did look at these 7 references which refer specifically to the flood itself, not creation or anything else. And the first reference, Matthew 24, it's actually Jesus speaking to his disciples saying that such and such was the days of Noah, where they're eating and drinking and marrying and so on. And in Luke, it refers to the genealogy of the righteous, which we've heard from Jason, that Noah was from that righteous line going back to Adam and to God. Jesus again mentions the flood in Luke 17. The flood came and destroyed them all. And of course, Hebrews 11:7 refer to the fact that through faith, Noah and his family were saved. Then we have Peter, who was more fixated on the flood, and refers to it 3 times, referring to the ark and so on. And we're going to look at this one passage from 2 Peter chapter 3. And you can see, somebody just wants to read this out to save my voice. So Peter isn't exactly commending these people. He calls them scoffers, and they're scoffing, and they've got sinful desires, and they deliberately overlook facts. And then he talks about the fact that creation and a deluge of water are two events which they don't acknowledge. And it says, for example, where it says here, the earth was formed out of water and through water by the word of God. That's referring to creation. And then the second one, of course, that it was then destroyed by a flood. But the world says that this took millions of years, right? And this is not a common accepted agenda. Yes?
Question about that passage.
Jade, where are you at?
Good man.
This might be a little bit off topic, but I've always wondered in this passage what he's referring to when he says, ever since the fathers fell asleep. Who are the fathers? What is he referring to there? Is that the patriarchs? Is that all that is? Or is there something else there?
Basically, that's what I've understood. It's, that ever since the original, whoever they were, fell asleep, things have just changed and gone on and on, same, all right? That there was no... Now, they don't acknowledge the flood, so they probably wouldn't be acknowledging Noah and Adam.
That's what I was kind of confused about.
Yeah. It's hard to know, but the main point here is that this is the statement by Lyle, as we were talking about last week, the present is key to the past. In other words, what we see now has been happening forever. That's really what he's saying here. Ever since way back when, nothing has changed. And that's how we have what we have. And so I read an article this week, and this work said this, around 70,000 years ago, a supervolcanic eruption in Indonesia nearly wiped out humanity. Genetic evidence suggests that the human population dropped to just a few thousand. Had the decline been any worse, human civilization may never have recovered or developed as we know it today. I think it dropped to around 8, didn't it? And I think they're a little out on the 70,000, actually a lot. But this is what happens with the scientific community, that they ignore, as Peter writes here, facts that, and we're going to see the fact that they ignore. And so this has been the paradigm up till recently, the last couple hundred years, I should say. But now people are starting to question it. And I'm just going to go through this quickly just because I find it so fascinating about Mount St. Helens, right? How that at 8 o'clock on April the 18th, 1980, a landslide from the volcano came down and the water came into the Spirit Lake there and actually washed up on the other side and cleaned all the vegetation off the other side of the lake. And those logs are the vegetation that was there originally. And we're going to come back to that. And then that was the beginning of the volcanic eruption, but it wasn't lava, it was ash that was falling down on the mountain and the surrounding area. And in the following week, all this ash was on top of the ice and snow on the mountain, over superheating it, causing a steam explosion, which created a crater. And then there was another ash volcanic eruption, and there was another mudslide that partially filled this crater. And then finally there was another landslide which overflowed the edge of the crater, and we have today everything that flowed down that mountain. And the reason I say that is, looking at that, we can see how that could happen. But if you go down into those canyons there, you would swear that that's like the Grand Canyon. It's rock, right? The ash and so on has just created rock, which is hard, and it only took a matter of a few years. And yet, people say this has to take millions of years. And I'm really jumping ahead a little bit, but this happens with all of sedimentary rock. And when I talk about sedimentary rock, I'm talking about most of North America, including the Grand Canyon, is sedimentary rock. So we'll get there. Anyway, then we see these layers, what we talked about, strata. There is the first layer of ash, then there's the steam explosion, then there's the second eruption, and then finally the dirt and debris from the last, which caused the thing to collapse. And it created these layers. And people are saying, I've seen this before somewhere. Like here, and here, and here, all over the world. And that certainly wasn't from a volcanic eruption. What was it from? And they're so blind to it, because it had to be something cataclysmic, not just gradually wearing away. And every part of the world has this type of strata in it. So from there, we went back to this picture. We talked a little bit about how coal was formed. Coal, scientists agree, is a result of organic matter, trees and so on. It gets compressed under heavy weight of earth and temperature. And then a little while it creates coal. And they talk about this having to take millions of years, but they found that it can be done in less than a century to form a layer of coal. So if another landslide were to come down now, it would cover all the... Remember we talked about the bark and so on that settled in the bottom of the lake. If it covered that, it would be creating another seam of coal. But the thing is, when you see coal structures all across North America, it's not because there's a lake there. So how did that happen, right? They just ignore it. But they do see that in the coal structures, and we mentioned this last week, that here's a coal seam with a tree going through it. Now, if that took millions of years, this tree would have rotted long ago. Same thing there. There's a tree right through the coal seam. It's enlarged here. There's another tree stump, and so on. In the coal seams, there's these trees which haven't rotted, so they had to be buried quickly in order to do this, and we can see how that would happen. And even if they didn't form coal, they would become petrified and exist. And sometimes the coal actually can be seen as in the form of actual organic matter. So it had to have happened quickly and completely. Any questions so far? That was a little quick survey. I think you've all seen this before. And then we went into strata. Strata just means the layers. And what we noticed about the layers was what? Do you remember? I'm sorry?
No sediment in between?
There's nothing in between them. They're just one layer after another, straight lines. If that took millions of years, when one layer is down, then dirt would get on it, plants would grow in it, animals would dig in it, the environment would erode it, and it would be a mess before the next layer came. But the fact that they are laid down one after the other, means that it was done quickly. It wasn't over millions of years. Well, what event could have done that? Well, we'll look at that in a minute. Here is the guy who started geology. He wrote his textbook back in the 1800s, three of them, and his mantra is the present is the key to the past, and his principles of geology is uniformitarianism, which means that everything's going on the same since the fathers went to sleep. And he did this, as we'll see in a few minutes, to counteract the story of the flood and of creation. His theory states that all the natural laws of the universe that are in existence now existed at the beginning of time, and all changes happen slowly over time, and they add up to larger changes. But he doesn't take into account how these layers could happen so quickly. But this guy, I called him George. J. Harlan was the guy's name, not George Brett. He went against the flow in the 20s, and it took him 50 years to get accepted that these things happen quickly. And he was looking at this lake that we were talking about in Washington. And you can see here, these are called rhythmites, and I'm going to talk about those a little bit later. And here's how big they are. There's a man standing on top of the mountain of rhythmites. And there's hundreds of them, right? How could that happen? The Missouri shore, that's full of fossils and seashells, way inland. The ripple beds from water washing over top of the ground, they figure the water had to be at least 100 feet deep. And then these potholes caused by whirlpools as the water was running quickly. The scab lands, which washed all dirt off the top. So this was done by one cataclysmic event of water. It eroded this falls gorge and it moved this mountain, you can see, of this rock. You can see how big it is with that man standing beside it. He says, this is not something that takes millions of years. This had to have happened in a hurry. But Charles Lyell says this, the first rule that geological change comes from slow, continual procedures that have been happening over a long period of time. And anyone taking geology has to agree to this. The second rule is that all forces that affect the geology of the earth come from the earth. In other words, no God. And the third rule is the celestial cycles do not impact the patterns of the earth's geological record. In other words, there's no out of the world operations that are changing. And then, of course, Charles Darwin picked up his book and took it on the Beagle with him, and as a result, we've got our theory of evolution. But I've got George again. J. Harlan Bretz was again finally was accepted. There's another one we mentioned here just briefly. In this, there are seashells. This is right inland here, right? Way in there. Seashells and fossils of marine animals. The canyon lands, which are scab lands, again. The talus free slopes, which means that there isn't a lot of debris falling from them, because if they have a cliff that's been around for, let's say, a million years, wouldn't you expect a lot of stuff to be falling off the edge and piling up? There's very little here. And then there's the Grand Canyon. We're going to talk about that in a minute. The rhythmites. And then here we have more of the rhythmites. You can't see it very well. That was the best I could do. But the Grand Canyon is an interesting study because, as I said, it's composed of sedimentary rock. Sedimentary rock can be in the form of shale, in the form of sandstone, or similar rocks. And let's look at that. This is a kind of a sketch of North America. And the gray part here is all sedimentary rock. This, of course, Canadian Shield is granite, and so are the mountains up the coast. But this is sedimentary rock. And you say, well, maybe there's a little bit of water, but look how thick it is. 15,000 feet deep. Think of that. That's almost, well, how's your math? Almost 5 miles, 8 kilometers, right? That's how deep it is. Now, that's not something that just happened. And you'll see how the magnitude of this. Not only that, they find that there are particulars that are from the Smoky Mountains here in the east, including things like uranium and other materials that are actually deposited in Death Valley over here. So it has been washed across the continent. And they haven't got an answer for it. But also, this layer of sandstone is like this. It's layers of shale and sandstone and other different sedimentary layers. Layer upon layer, something like the rhythmites. So what do I mean by the rhythmites? They are rock layers that are laid down, and they have straight lines in between them, so therefore they're laid down quickly, but small amounts, a little bit at a time. I want you to think about, let's suppose the globe is covered with water. What forces are acting on the Earth when it's covered with water? What would cause the water to be moving? The wind, all right? Tide. Every day, twice a day, the tides are going to pull the water up one side of the Earth, right? And then as it rotates, that water is going to wash every layer of rhythmite every time it goes around. When the moon comes by, another one. When the sun comes by, another one. And that's why there's hundreds of these layers. They're just layers of this water dropping this sediment on the Earth. So let's have a closer look at these. There are actually six layers, or seven, and six layers. The first is called the Soc mega sequence. They're called mega sequences. This is not on the final exam. Okay. Then there's the Tippecanoe. I don't know who was thinking of that word. Tippecanoe. Kaskaskia mega sequence. And then a couple of smaller ones. And then there's another one not mentioned here. It's called the Teus. But here's what they look like. If you go across the United States, you can see that the stalk sequence, mega sequence, is very thick. If you look at the measurement, this light green color, and it doesn't mean that it's all the same stuff, because it shows here it's made of something at the bottom and then a bunch of limestone. This is all limestone. This is limestone with shale down here, shale. But this is somewhere around 3,000 meters just here in Georgia. Just this one layer of called the Soc mega sequence. And then as time goes on, there's another mega sequence called the Tippecanoe, and it's not nearly as thick. And then the Kaskaskia is thinner again, and then the others are much thinner until the Gia isn't really visible. But this is what the North American continent looks like. And there's other places in the world like this, but this is an interesting study. Where does all of this sediment come from? This is not slow, gradual process. So in the flood, I'll give you advanced thinking here, there are two processes. There's the first process of the flood, and then that's the inundatory stage, right? It's inundated. It's completely more than flooded. It's just inundated with water. And then there's the recessive stage where it all runs off, because we know that after a while, God allowed the water to run off. So the first stage is going to form all these layers. And then the second stage, when the water's running off, it's going to reveal these layers with these channels like we see in the Grand Canyon. Now, they talk about the Grand Canyon and this river gradually wearing it down, but they don't tell us how those layers got there. They ignore that. How in the world does that... We were at the Grand Canyon, it was over a mile deep where we were. How do all those layers of sandstone get formed in the first place? It's sedimentary rock. Sedimentary means settle to the bottom of water. And that's where scientists just don't make sense at all. They come up with these millions of years, but none of it makes sense. So we see this all over the world. It's not just the Grand Canyon. It's not just North America. Mexico, Argentina, Oregon, French Alps, all these layers. And here's some interesting ones. I don't know if you've ever driven out west, but here's Drumheller, which is the badlands of Alberta. This is where they find all the dinosaurs, and we're going to talk about that next week. You see both processes here, don't you? You see the laying down of the layers, and then you see some sort of cataclysmic event that wears them all away. And you say, well, how in the world can the event wear away rock? Well, it didn't, because they're being formed. They're still soft. Then the water rushes through, and then they harden, right, over time. So they didn't have to be fully hardened when that water rushed out and washed them away. Both of these are prime examples of how the flood has the layers and the recessive activity. Any questions there? It's not making sense, or it is making sense?
What do you think about the idea that the continents were actually separating, maybe due to some sort of rift?
You've been looking at my slides, haven't you?
No, I didn't know. I know some creation scientists postulate that.
I'm just getting there.
Okay, I didn't know if that was...
Good question, though. It is a good question. And there's good reason to think of that. And I think it answers an awful lot of questions that people have about the flood. But I'm going to go back and talk about these layers. Here's some layers as they look around the world. You say, how in the world do those layers get laid like that? What do you think the answer would be? First of all, you can see that the actual seams were layers at one point, right? And then they're all twisted and so on. So in other words, while they're still fresh, some sort of cataclysmic event like a volcano, earthquake or something has buckled them and bent them so that they are no longer nice and flat. That's all that's happened there. They're still, while they're fresh. If those had been a result of a volcano and so on, while after they had been around for millions of years, they wouldn't be so nicely connected. They would be broken So it's interesting because we're going to talk about what else was going on besides just water in a few minutes. And here's what we read in the book of Psalms 104. Would someone read this?
He set the earth on its foundations so that it should never be moved. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At your review, they fled. At the sound of your thunder, they took to flight. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place that you appointed for them. You set a boundary that they may not pass, so that they might not again cover the earth.
So is this talking about creation?
No.
Why not?
You say why not?
Why isn't it talking about creation?
It says
okay, yeah. One good answer. And?
Verse 9, you set a boundary that they will not pass, so that they might not again.
Again. That's right. That's the point. They might not again cover the earth. So in other words, they're talking here about the flood, and God promised he would not again cover the earth with a flood. So this is the flood he's talking about here, and he's talking about something more than just water. He's saying mountains rose, valleys sank down. So after the flood, there was an awful lot going on underwater. Noah and his buddies were quietly coasting on top, but the bottom was nothing but turmoil, right? So let's talk about Jeremy's question here. If we look at the present map of the world, we see what's called tectonic plates. A tectonic plate is something like a section of, well, we'll look at this one, a section of the Earth's surface which is separated from other sections, and in between they're crashing together. Now, we'll look at one particular, and that's along here. You've heard of the San Andreas Fault. Well, in the last few weeks, there have been many, many earthquakes on the West Coast. That's because these two tectonic plates are gradually crashing into each other and causing those. And so the East Coast is prone to some dramatic earthquake, they say, in the near future. It doesn't happen in a lot of places because the plates are coming together where nobody's going to be bothered, right? And away out in the Antarctic Ocean and so on. But here's where some are together. We know there's a fair amount of activity around Japan and in the, that area. Also, we know around the middle of Central America, there's a fair amount of activity, all because these plates are moving around. Well, scientists have been investigating this, and first of all, we might say, have you ever noticed, look here, how these continents seem to be, they look like they fit together, almost like a jigsaw puzzle, they come apart. And if we were to move them, you can see how they could fit together like that. We're just speculating at this point, but as a matter of fact, they find that that was the case. And they say, how in the world would they know that? Well, if they take magnetic particles that are in the soil and see what direction the magnetic particles are pointing, they find that they're not pointing to the north and south like they are would be today. They're pointing in another direction. In other words, there's been a lot of cataclysmic turning and gyrating of this soil. Now, this is not just long Earth scientists, it's young Earth scientists who are believing this too. The only difference is the length of time it takes to do this. I want someone to read in Genesis 1, and we'll read verse 9 down to, well, we'll just read 9 and 10. Now, this is just part of what went on in the third day. Later on, it talks about plants that grew and so on. But how long did it take God to bring the dry land up out of the water?
He said it, and it was.
Okay. And at the most, let's say half a day, right? Because he did something else later on with all the plants. So why should we be concerned about how long it took these tectonic plates to move around? If God can do it the first time, remember, how did the earth start out when it was created? Without form and void, darkness was on the face of the deep. Jason was telling us this on Sunday. And where was the earth? Under the water. And now he's saying the earth is coming up through the water in verse 6, or 9, I mean. In a half a day. Couldn't he do the same thing? What he's done now with the flood is he has covered the earth with water, and now he's going to bring the earth up through the water again in his own purpose. So here is what many scientists believe has happened. And this will answer some of the questions I've always had. They say that the original land space that God created wasn't anything like what we see today. If you're looking for where the Garden of Eden was, it's not in our world. It was a landmass something like this. Because of the orientation of the magnetic field in these this landmass. And then as a time went on, old age scientists, millions of years, we say, a very short period of time, we had God do something. Look what it says in Genesis 6:13. Someone read that for us. So, if I said I got hit with a ball, what does the word with mean? If I got hit with a ball, it means that I got hit with, by a ball. Or, I got hit and so did the ball. Both of us with it. Right? The ball got hit with me. You see what I mean? And the original word here actually has both meanings here. I will destroy them with the earth, and I will destroy them by the earth. It means both. Right? They were swamped by water, and the earth destroyed them too. There were some cataclysmic events going on here. Right? Things like volcanoes, earthquakes, and landslides, valleys, mountains. And so gradually, these land masses are separating. God is doing this. Now, older scientists are putting names to them because they say it lasted a long, long time. But we don't believe it did. This would have been in a matter of, if he can do it in a half a day, he can do it in a year, right? And gradually, now you're seeing some resemblance of. So, have you ever wondered how in the world we have duck-billed platypuses and kangaroos and Tasmanian devils in Australia, but nowhere else in the world? Does this help answer that? The bunch of them got off the ark and say, hey, let's go over this corner. Oops, we're separated from them all because we're floating away, right? This is after the flood. And so this is how various animals ended up in places that other animals are not. And so gradually it takes place, and you can see how eventually this landmass came around. This is what young Earth and old Earth scientists say happened in the past. Only young Earth scientists say it happened after the flood.
Right after the flood, like Noah and his family didn't walk out to that.
No.
You're saying that they walked out to a sort of unified earth, but then as time went on, it started to.
In a short period of time, yeah. And also, at the same time, there would be great earthquakes, mountain ranges, because if we looked at the Himalayan range, it is part of where two tectonic plates come together. The Rocky Mountains, where tectonic plates come together. That's just helpful, but we don't know. I'm just saying that this is how they figure it can be explained, and I don't think we have to say, you know, this is gospel truth, but it sure makes sense to me. There was one other point I wanted to make here. Anyway, I forgot. We'll get it next week. Anything else that you want to ask on that?
Yeah, there was also a theory that was postulated that within about 500 years after the flood that there was a global ice age because of all the volcanic ash and all of the disruption that the whole earth underwent during the flood. And with that ice age, that would have created a lot of land bridges from continent to continent. And then as the ice melted as the ash, I guess, cleared away for the sun to melt, mm-hmm. Melt all of that ice that the continents formed. So it's likely that mass, land mass, was broken apart during the flood.
Mm-hmm. Could be. Yeah. That's possible.
And then the water just came back.
The other thing is you find people saying, well, there's no way the water could cover all the mountains. That's a tremendous volume of water. But before the flood, there probably weren't high mountains. They came as a result of the tectonic plates moving together. So there are possible answers there. But again, as I say, we can't be dogmatic about anything. We just know that God did it somehow and that we have what we have. We have to trust him for it. Because we don't have a lot of time, we're not going to get into it. I'm going to get into fossils next week, very brief sketch of them, and also the ark itself, some of the possibilities of how that was handled. So any other questions or comments? I don't know what we'll do when it comes to the pods, because we're not going to expect you to regurgitate a lot of this stuff, but it's I'll just pray and we'll close. Lord, we thank you for your magnificent power. We thank you for your truth and your word. And we trust you. We know that you did what you said you did, and how we can understand it, we possibly can't, but we marvel at your power and your strength, and we see your handprint in all that you do. May we learn to trust you more. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.